This is Chuck Green, and today is October 20-something, 2014. And my friend Than Lawton has encouraged me to make an oral record of my life. And so I'm sitting here with him, and I'm going to try to try not to be too boring. I have no idea who might listen to this. I think the only people that would ever listen to it would be the people most interested, which could be my kids, Dave and Holly, or probably grandkids with Karis and Kason and Chloe, if you want to know your grandfather a little bit better. But I was born in Huntington, West Virginia, and didn't live there long. Moved to St. Louis, and then didn't live there long, but moved to Fort Madison, Iowa. Fort Madison, Iowa is the home of Schaefer Pen Company. My dad was with the Schaefer Pen Company 43 years. It was kind of an interesting story about my dad, and that is he, the way he interviewed for that job for Schaefer, he was he grew up in a tiny little town in Mississippi called Crenshaw, Mississippi, and he was the oldest of four, and his father was not much, and so my dad had to just drop out of school and go to work, and he worked at what they called back then a soda jerk. He worked at the local drugstore. The local drugstore had everything in those little towns, and they had a counter, kind of a lunch counter where you could go and get milkshakes or sandwiches. But also they sold Schaefer pens, amongst other pens. And about once every 3 months, this pen salesman from Schaefer would come by and replenish the stock. And my dad thought he must have the greatest job in the world. So my dad said, "Can you tell me how I can get a job like yours?" And the guy said, "Well, I'll tell you the next time Schaefer's is hiring up in Fort Madison, and then you can take it from there." Well, no, lo and behold, a few months later, he contacted my dad and said, "Schaefer's going to be hiring this weekend, and if you can get yourself up there, an interview for a job, for a sales job." So my dad had no idea where Fort Madison, Iowa was from Crenshaw, Mississippi. And he didn't have a car, so he borrowed a car and got a map and took off. And he's headed for Fort Madison, Iowa. Well, lo and behold, the car broke down. And I can just picture my dad with a map spread over the front seat, but the car broke down. And he limped into some little town, I don't even know the name of it, and pulled into a garage with a mechanic. And they finally figured out what was wrong, but he said it was going to take, they're going to have to order a part out of Detroit, Michigan. And my dad just could not do that. And so he went across the street to the boarding house and checked into the boarding house. Well, middle of the night, my dad did not have any money, so he went out the window of the boarding house and went out to the street and started hitchhiking to Fort Madison, Iowa. And he got to Fort Madison, Iowa, and he went into the bathroom there on the main floor with his suitcase, kind of took a spit bath, and changed into a suit, probably a borrowed suit, and was checking in for his interview. They were interviewing a lot of guys, and they would go from one interviewer to the next. About three or four people would interview this long line of men. And the last interviewer was Mr. Schaefer himself, and Mr. Craig Schaefer. And he was the one who he'd open their file, and he'd say yes or no about whether the candidate, they were going to hire him. And so my dad was eighth grade education, and coming out of Mississippi, he didn't handle those interviews well. By the time he got to Mr. Schaefer, Mr. Schaefer took to open his file, and he said, "Mr. Green, thank you very much for coming, but we're not going to be able to use you. We're not going to be able to hire you." And my dad stood up, this young Mississippi guy. He wasn't a hick, but he wasn't far from it. And he leaned across the deck and looked right in Mr. Schaefer's eyes. And Mr. Schaefer, I don't know what that file says, but I know I can sell Schaefer pens. And Mr. Schaefer stood up and he leaned across the desk, looked in my dad's eyes, says, "I think you can too." So they hired him, gave him a job, gave him his first territory, which was Huntington, West Virginia. And that's where he met my mom, and then they married, and then my older sister Kelly was born, and I was born, and then we moved over to St. Louis, and then up to Fort Madison. The Fort Madison's right on the Mississippi River, and it was a wonderful experience growing up on that river, just fabulous. It was kind of like a Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn experience, and it was just great. There were always things for us to do that were around the river, and the river was not a clean river. And I know my parents and others said, "Do not swim in the river." Of course, we never paid any attention to that, and we'd dive off or jump off the bridge. We didn't really dive off the bridge that goes across it. And every year, there were some people trying to swim across it. It was a mile wide at that place, and just real rough currents. I never was able to swim across it. But, boy, we had some great times on that river with riverboat and John boat and skiing in that filthy, dirty, muddy Mississippi. But, boy, we had a lot of fun. And I will say this, just talking about a couple interesting stories, that Mr. Schaefer also had a yacht. Now, it's not a lot yacht like you'd see it today, but Fort Madison, Iowa, it was a yacht. It was just a big boat. And he had a dock there on the whatever little port we had. We didn't have much of a port. We just had some docks. Well, we would try to sneak on to Mr. Schaefer's boat. And I'll never forget that we, one summer, we went to church camp. And we met these two girls from New London, Iowa. It must have been seventh grade. And they were twins. They were the Shipley twins. I don't remember their first names, but we called them the Shapley Shipleys. And so, lo and behold, I was interested in one, and this other guy from our church was interested in the other. And so, once camp was over, we had no way of seeing them. They lived 30 or 40 miles away, but we knew that Mr. Schaefer had a phone on his yacht. So we would sneak down on Mr. Schaefer's yacht and make these phone calls to the Shapley Shipleys, not realizing that eventually it's a long-distance call, and somebody's going to see this long-distance bill, and we're eventually going to get caught. Well, sure enough, we did get caught, and it was not a pleasant experience. But anyway, we did, and that was fun. We grew up in a house right on, not Main Street, but it was kind of like, it was a little bit like a Mayberry, Andy Griffith, the old Andy Griffith show. But it was a good house, and there were three of us, three kids. Kelly, older than me, 18 months, and Betty, 3 years younger than me. But this house, we always kind of wonder. Now we wonder. When you're kids, you think that house is big, but it only had 1.5 baths. And the bathroom upstairs only had a tub. There was no shower. And so then there's a little powder room, half bath downstairs. And we always wonder now, how did we, especially when we were teenagers, how did we all make it with, including my parents, with just one bathtub? But we never thought about it then. Everybody just did it. But it was a great house. And I will say, my interest in the Presbyterian Church started off in a little nefarious way. Out my bedroom window, across the alley, across the backyard in the alley, was the Presbyterian Church. And it had a stained glass window. Well, I thought it might be fun to shoot my BB gun at the stained glass window and just see if I how accurate I could be, and would the BBs really get all that way. And you know, something they did. But I couldn't really tell. It was far enough to where I couldn't tell if the BBs were actually hitting the window. Well, I found out one night when there was a knock on our door, and went to the door. I didn't go to the door. My dad went to the door, and it was a policeman, and it was the minister from the Presbyterian Church. Now, we were Methodists back then, so we didn't know that Presbyterian minister very well, but we were about to get to know him. And he said, "Mr. Green, is your son Chuck around?" "Oh, yeah." So I got dragged in the living room. It was very, very uncomfortable and awkward. And I had to confess, well, the BBs were taking all the chips out of this stained glass. And so needless to say, I got in a lot of trouble about that. I don't remember how it all worked. I think that my dad had to pay to get it fixed, and I was supposed to pay my dad back. I don't know. I probably have to make payments still. But so anyway, that's what I did. Now, parents and sisters, it's kind of interesting back then because we were close, but we weren't open and vulnerable that we are today in our culture. And in one sense, we were a close family. In another sense, we weren't very open and didn't really talk about real meaningful things. But they would say that, people would say that we were close. And my dad traveled every week. He traveled for Schaefer's. He'd leave Monday morning and come back Thursday night. And so he was gone a lot. But we didn't know any better, any different. My mom didn't work, and she was constantly doing the chocolate chip cookies and things like that you read about and hear about, and that we'd come home from school, and there we were, chocolate chip cookies, and such a great, just such a great experience as a kid. Now, as I got into my teens, the next big thing, I think, is getting my driver's license. And 16 years old, birth date September 12th, 1946. So this is September 12th in 62, and I turned 16. And back then, you wanted to get your license the very day you turned 16. So I remember getting my license, and my dad had a 1958 Volkswagen Beetle convertible. Oh, man, it was pretty cool. Back then, it was real cool in Fort Madison, Iowa. And so that's what I would be driving. So I remember the day I got my license. I put the top down. It was a pretty day in September, and picked up a few of my buddies, and we just had to do something. And we went out to the cornfield, which is out on the west end of town. And they said, "Let's just drive through this cornfield." Oh, it sounded like such a great idea. Well, the corn is as high as the elephant's eye, it says in the musical Oklahoma. And that corn was pretty high. But also, that corn was pretty ripe. It hadn't been picked yet. They don't pick it until the end of September, October. So we go flying through the cornfield, and all of a sudden, these corn cobs are hitting the car, this little Volkswagen. It broke out both the headlights. It didn't break the windshield, thankfully, and had corn stalks all in the fenders and the bumpers and the tires. And that was another thing that I had to try to explain to my dad. And then another thing that about the same time, we had a Russian family in our town, and their name was Tshetty, of all names, Mr. Tshetty. And it became a badge of honor for the junior class in high school to do something to Mr. Tachetti. And so they would throw firecrackers on his front porch or do something that, you know, back then it was ornery. It wasn't quite as devastating as it is now. But, okay, we're going to do something to Mr. Tachetti. We're going to throw firecrackers on his front porch. So lo and behold, about four or five guys piled in this little VW convertible. Back then, we all had Army hats on. Somewhere or other, that was a craze. And we thought we were real commandos. And we went by his house, and we turned the lights off in the Volkswagen. And we drove down right in front of his house and started lighting a bunch of firecrackers, cherry bombs, and M80s, and throwing them on his porch. And then we took off. Just took off like as fast as you can drive one of those little Volkswagens. And we took off, and lo and behold, one of the guy's hats flew off. And he says, I got to get my hat. I said, forget that. We'll get caught. No, let's just drive around the block and see. So we drove around the block, and as we are sitting in the car down the block at the intersection, and the car is kind of rumbling, we're looking, and there are no lights on at Mr. Tachetti's house. And the hat was right in the middle of the street. Well, we said, I think we can sneak up and lean over and get the hat. So sure enough, lights out. We pull down the road. And just when one of the guys was leaning over and pulling in the hat, we heard bam, bam. Lo and behold, we took off. It was a gunshot. I thought we were being shot at. And we took off, and everybody's just, you can just imagine 16-year-old kids were just scared to death. And then as we got several blocks down, I mean, there was only one Volkswagen in town. So, you know, they didn't have to guess whose was. But what happened is he had shot out a tire on this Volkswagen. And after a few blocks, as that, you know, the air comes out, all of a sudden we are in trouble. So we changed the tire and, of course, took all those guys home. But now I've got to take home this Volkswagen, my dad's car. And I try to explain a bullet hole in the spare tire. And that was not easy to explain, so much so that I chose not to do it that night. And hoping that he wouldn't realize that there's, you know, that the spare tire is now on the left rear wheel, and he won't even look in the trunk to see the bullet hole tire. Well, the next day I was at school, and we had only two policemen in Fort Madison, and one of them was a big black man whose last name was Carter, and we called him Asafa Cotta. We just tried to, now, we didn't do that to his face, but we called him Asafa Cotta, and then the other guy was named Bartholomew, Brad Bartholomew. Well, Brad Bartholomew had a glass eye, and we used to say he only had 20 vision, but what we did is we nicknamed him Bad Eye Bart. So Bad Eye Bart and Asafa Cotta. Well, lo and behold, the next day I'm in school, and there was a courtyard around all the classes where you could kind of see through and see the hallway. And I noticed in the hallway the principal of the school, Arlo Woods, walking down the hallway with Bad Eye Bart. And he comes to where I'm in class, and the principal leans in and he says, we'd like to see Chuck Green, please. Well, my heart is just, I just can't even breathe. And I go with them, the Bad Eye Bart, and to the principal's office. And old Bad Eye said, get in the back of the squad car. Someplace I need to take you and talk to you about. Oh, man. And I just was so afraid that it was going to be about Mr. Tachetti. I mean, why wouldn't it be? I got a man so mad he's shooting at us. And my car is the easiest one to recognize. So we go to the police station, which is real tiny. And we go into the police station. And he said, I want you, Joe Green, I want you to go in that room. And I want you to have a seat. And I want you to wait until I come. And I open that door, and lo and behold, who's sitting there but Mr. Tichetti? And now I have to go in and sit down by Mr. Tichetti and try to come to grips with what's happening. Well, it was not good, and I tried to apologize and fall all over myself. And Mr. Tichetti just felt he was so persecuted at being a Russian, which he was. And so... anyway, I got in a lot of trouble for that, too. But this was all happening when I was 16 in September. And then just 4 months later is when I had my accident. But before I get into the accident, let me just say that a big part of my life was sports. I loved sports, man, loved to play sports, loved to watch sports. But there's only one problem. I wasn't very good at sports. I wasn't very fast. I couldn't jump very well. I was well coordinated, but I just wasn't that good. But I still just loved sports. But it seemed like I was always on the second team, scrimmaging the first team, and always getting run over by the first team. But I just really enjoyed it, and that was a big part of my life. Another big part of my life back then was we belonged to a little country club there, 9-hole golf course with a little country club. And the summer before I turned 16 in September, when I was going into my junior year, I was a lifeguard at the pool. And those were just wonderful, fond memories of being a lifeguard. And during the summer, I really can't, you know, explain. Words kind of escape me, but it just has such a neat memory for me. Well, then came my accident. It was January 17th, 1963, just 4 months after I turned 16, and I was on the gymnastics team, and I was jumping on the trampoline in the last period of the day. If you weren't if you weren't in class, you could opt out, and the last period of the day could be like your PE if you're involved in a sport. If you're involved in a sport, you didn't have to take PE. So the last period of the day was kind of reserved for everybody that was involved in a sport. And so I wanted to play basketball, but again, I wasn't very good. So I started jumping on a trampoline, and I actually got pretty good on a trampoline, so good that we even bought one to have in our backyard. And I just never forget. In fact, I can still feel the canvas of that trampoline. I can still smell it. It's amazing how those things never go away. But I would come in from a date or something, and in the backyard, and that trampoline would be open. It was a fenced-in yard, and I just come in and all my clothes, jacket, and I just start jumping on the trampoline at, you know, midnight or whatever time I was coming in, and doing all kinds of silly flips and everything. And I always wondered that if I'd ever had my accident in my backyard at midnight, I would have never made it, and I would have never lived. So I'm thankful that this happened at school. Well, it turned out that the state of Iowa high school gymnastic meet was coming up a week, I think it was like the 19th, in Iowa City at the University of Iowa. And I wanted really bad to enter on the trampoline. And I had entered, and I was going to be part of it. But lo and behold, that week, I came down with the flu. And so on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, my mom held me out of school because I was so sick. I mean, and she should have held me out of school for my sake, but more for the other kids, too. But I convinced her on that. I knew I had to get to the gym to practice the trampoline. So I convinced her on that Thursday that I was just fine. And I really wanted to go back to school. Sure. She knew me better than that. And she knew what I wanted to do. So I went back on that Thursday. And sure enough, Thursday afternoon, everybody gets out of class, is in a sport, and everybody's in the gym, the basketball team and the weightlifters and the wrestlers and the gymnastics. We didn't have much of a gymnastics team. I mean, it wasn't a full-blown team, just a couple of us that had entered the state contest. So I started jumping on the trampoline, and lo and behold, I was doing some fancy flip. And I landed right on my head. And the way I have figured it now is that my timing was just off. My strength was off because of the flu. My timing was off, and I didn't get all the way over. So I landed right on my head, right in the middle of the trampoline, and my neck broke. Now, you just don't realize that. We certainly didn't realize it. Back then, because back then, people with broken necks did not survive. They did not live. And so you didn't hear of spinal cord units and things like that. So I didn't know what was happening. All I know is that after I did that trick and I landed on my head, that I still had to come to rest on the canvas. If you throw a tennis ball up, man, it was going pretty high. If you throw a tennis ball up and it bounces once, well, it's got to dribble out to stop. And that's what happened to my body. And I remember seeing my body, all my arms and legs whirling around me, but I couldn't feel them. I couldn't feel anything from my neck down. And I remember I finally landed and, somebody thought I was just goofing around, you know, somebody else's turn, and that I was just goofing around. And finally, they realized that they better get somebody. I couldn't talk. I didn't have breath, and I couldn't speak. So I couldn't tell anybody that I couldn't move. They just figured out. So they contacted the 911. There was no 911 back there. But they called the ambulance. And I'll never forget my sister, Kelly, coming into the gym screaming. And I also won't forget that my parents were going out of town for about a week that next day, Friday, I think it was, for about a week. And, oh, man, we were going to have a house, not to ourselves, but it was, you know, we were going to be able to party as best we partied back then. And I said, oh, man, I'm messing this up. We're not going to be able to party, and I've probably broken an arm or something. I'll probably have to wear a cast. Won't get to be in the gymnastics meet. I had no idea the seriousness. So they took me to the little Fort Madison Hospital. And I'll never forget that my mother met me at that hospital. I was always afraid for her, what she going to think and how she going to take this. Not that she'd be upset at me, but just her heart would be broken. And as they rolled me into the emergency room, my mother was there, and she said, "Well, son, it looks like you zigged when you should have zagged." And just a little expression like that, I've never forgotten, because I was so anxious to see her. I needed my mother. Even at 16, you need your mother when you're going through something like that. They took x-rays there, and they realized that it was serious. So they decided they would transfer me to the University of Iowa Medical Hospital College in Iowa City. And so it was about 90 miles. And so it took 3 hours because the ambulance did not want to roll over any railroad tracks or anything that might have jarred my neck. So I got up there, and a couple of interesting things happened there. At first, They wanted to put me in traction. Well, it sounds good, and today it's fine, but in 1963, the way they put you in traction is they shaved my head. Now, I don't have any feeling from my neck down, but that really hurt on top of my head when they're shaving, because they didn't use shaving cream. They just shaved my head. They then drilled two holes in the top of my head, literally they gave me whatever kind of antiseptic they could, or Novocaine, something. I forget what they gave me to deaden it, but I still could feel. They had these little drills, and they drilled two holes on top of my head. Now, if you picture this, I'm lying flat. They've drilled these two holes, and they put a pair of tongs, think of ice tongs, into each of those holes to come together. And they tied a rope, a rope, onto the end of those tongs, and drag it over the end of the bed, and they put 36 pounds of barbell weights on them. So here I am, scared to death, 16 years old, laying flat. They've drilled holes in my head. They've clamped it with these tongs, and now I have 36 pounds. And they did that because there was a real serious danger of me, if one of those cracked vertebrae, it was vertebrae 2, you know, there's 7 vertebrae in your neck, and the higher up is the more dangerous. And I broke vertebrae 2 and 3. And so you have these little broken bones. Now when somebody breaks their neck, they can go in and they can fuse those bones back together. But back then, they didn't do any fusion. So lo and behold, they did all that traction because they didn't want one of those broken bones to slip and sever my spinal cord, and then I would have been dead. So there's enough damage to the spinal cord that I was paralyzed, but it wasn't severed to where I was dead. So for 6 weeks, I had to have that those tongs in my head. Well, God is so good in so many ways, and I was not a believer back then. I thought I was, but I was not. And I look back now, and I can see God's plan, because the University of Iowa had at their hospital on January 1st of that year, 63, 17 days before my accident, they, along with 3 other hospitals in the country, were trying an experimental type of care. And the experiment they were trying was called an intensive care unit. Can you believe that one of the first 3 intensive care units was right there, University of Iowa, and there were 4 beds in it, and I was in that that ICU unit. They told my parents that they could see me for 5 minutes on the hour, every hour, because I started to hallucinate. And for 12 days, I hallucinated. And my parents didn't know if I was going to live or die, and they didn't miss an hour during those 12 days. They really pretty much lived on a bench in the hallway for those 12 days. Well, by the grace of God, I came out of the hallucination, and they thought now that I was going to live. But to what degree would I get anything back? So they transferred me to a private room where I would spend the next 2 months in Iowa City, again, watching the tractions, what they were watching. And then once they felt secure about the traction, they put a neck brace around me and unhooked the tongs. So I had to wear a neck brace for about a year, but I was able to be a little bit more mobile. So they decided that they would transfer me to a rehabilitation hospital in Burlington, Iowa, which is only 15 miles from my hometown of Fort Madison, instead of 90 miles from Iowa City. And that'd be so much better for my mom and my dad. My dad's trying to work, and my mom's trying to take care of me, but she's also got my two sisters at home. And so this was going to be a whole lot easier being 15 miles away. And I remember us inquiring, what is this kind of hospital? What do you mean when it says rehabilitation hospital? Well, this guy had left some money, Klein Memorial Hospital, and he wanted it to be a rehab hospital. But again, nobody knew too much what that meant. But providentially, the first day of its operation was January 1st, 1963, same day as the ICU unit at the University Hospital. And so it was open January 1st, and I was moving in, 2 months after my accident. That was probably mid-March. And they had about 30 patients, and they were all stroke patients, elderly stroke patients. Well, there was only one physical therapist. He's a real sharp guy, about 30, 32 years old. His name was Dick Sidoris. I've tried to find him and can't find him even now in recent years. Dick Sidoris took an interest in me, a personal interest in me, because he saw the stroke patients are not going to be able to get better, but this young 16-year-old kid can get better. So he took a personal interest in me, and he worked with me for the next 6 months. So 2 months in Iowa City, 6 months at the rehab hospital with intense rehab. And by the time the end of that 8 months in those two hospitals, I was able to do a little walking. I do a little walking with Lofstrand crutches. The first place I learned to walk was in the pool. That little rehab hospital had a pool. So the buoyancy, I was able to take some steps there. And lo and behold, I was able to have those metal Lofstrand crutches. So it was time for me to go home, 1st of September. And let me back up one thing else that happened. Getting hurt in January, going to the rehab hospital closer to my home in March. At the end of April, there was our junior-senior prom. And, of course, I wasn't involved with school, and some of the kids came to see me in Iowa City and in Burlington. And, however, kids get kind of tired of driving to see you and that kind of thing, and I don't mean that in any negative way. But I really wanted to go to my junior-senior prom. And they said that if I, lived up to a couple things, that they would let me go home just for a night to go to my prom. And I did, and I took my girlfriend at the time, Karen Holland. Karen was the nicest girl in our class, and probably still is. And I remember taking her, and I didn't really take her to the prom. My parents took me, and she met us at the prom. And the theme of the prom was April Love. And Pat Boone sang that great song, April Love. And that was a real highlight of me. That was the best day of those first few months. Well, at the end of August, it was time for me to go home and go back to school. I was going to go back to school in a wheelchair. But I'd missed a whole semester of my junior year. And they wanted me to go back and repeat my junior year. And my parents somehow really convinced them that that would destroy me emotionally and that I need to go on to my senior year and pick up whatever junior classes were necessary for me to graduate that year. And again, it's what a small town does. So I was a senior, and they were pushing me around between classes, different students, and I was not a good student at all. But I was going wheelchair, going to classes. But after school, I would go to therapy, physical therapy. And I was doing better and better on those metal crutches. So finally, when it came time to graduate from high school in that May, I was determined that I was going to be able to walk across the stage on crutches, walking. And by the grace of God, I did. And that was one of those monumental dates for me. Now, it came time to pick out a college. And I wasn't a good student, but it was just, we were just going to go to college. They were just, my parents and me, I guess, we just grew up thinking we're going to college. I'm going to college. But the snow and the ice was really, really hard to get around. And I'd even started driving back. Well, we wanted to find a college in a warmer weather that only had one-story buildings. So my dad started looking at colleges in Florida. Again, he, with the eighth-grade education, didn't know what to look for except one-story buildings in Florida. And I went to Jacksonville University. Jacksonville University, and when I got there, Jacksonville was a little commuter school, and it had 3,000 students, but it only had 240 students living on campus. They had 120 students in the male dorm, 120 in the female dorm, and the dorms connected. There was no living together, anything like that, and there were curfews, but the name of the men's dorm was called men's dorm, and female, it was called women's dorm. Not a lot of creativity, but and again, there was no ADA, the disability accessibility laws, so I was able to drive my car from the dorm over to the classrooms and function like that. College was kind of an interesting experience for me. I wasn't a Christian. I was trying so hard to be like everybody else and try to act like everybody else. Everybody was drinking and partying and everything else. So I was trying to do all that, but I really didn't enjoy it that much. It seemed like it was something I was supposed to do, but I didn't really enjoy it. But I did, and that's where I met my roommate, Larry Tribuco, and Larry eventually married my sister. So we've obviously kept up for the last 50 years through them and their son and our kids and cousins, and it's really been a great relationship through the years. So when I was about to graduate, I majored in marketing. I was about to graduate, and I was trying to think, what did I really want to do? I had a void in my life, and I didn't know what it was from. I just wasn't happy. And, of course, you kind of believe what the commercials are on TV, that the way you can achieve happiness is by having a lot of stuff, having the newest car and doing all kinds of things like that. So I said, I'm going to try to buy back the happiness that God had cheated me out of. So I moved to Miami, and I wanted to be a stockbroker. But Merrill Lynch would not hire me. I really wanted to go with Merrill Lynch back then. They were the biggest. They had the best training program. That's not necessarily true now, but it was back then. And they wouldn't hire me. They said I was just too young. And they said, you need to get experience either in sales or in finance. Well, I thought I could sell, but I didn't know anything about finance. So I went to work. I got a job at a bank, Miami Beach First National Bank, for 2 years. And it was a great experience. I really enjoyed it, really enjoyed the people. And it was a great experience. And I might just slip in this little. When I can't sleep nowadays, and I'm trying to, some people count sheep or whatever, one thing that I have tried to do is I try to think how many people I can remember from Miami Beach First National Bank and their names and that kind of thing. And once I finish that, I go to Merrill Lynch, where I did get on, and try to remember names there. And Because they were just positive experiences in my life. So after that 2 years in Miami Beach, I was able to get on with Merrill Lynch and went to New York for training. for them for 3 months. And that was quite an experience. By then, I was walking with a cane. And that was, you know, and again, I'm trying so hard to be as normal as I can be. In New York, you know, you don't take a car. You got to ride the subway. And there's pushing and shoving, getting on the subway. And here I am with a cane, a little bit unstable, and a briefcase in one hand, cane in the other, and trying to be normal. So the two or three things that happened in New York just the 3 months I was there. The very first night we were there, we stayed at the Park Royal Hotel on West 72nd Street, maybe West 73rd, a block off the Central Park. And it's still there. Now it's an upscale hotel. Back then, we called it Park Royal. We called it Park Roach. But the very first night we were there, there were 80 of us in my training class, and we all stayed at that hotel. Now the hotel had room for, you know, a few hundred. We weren't the only people there. But they had a cocktail party to welcome us in the lobby of that hotel that evening. And one of our guys went to the men's room and got stabbed in the neck. I'll just never forget that. And I just decided that I'm just never going to go to the restroom the whole 3 months I was there, or not a public restroom, or certainly not go alone. So he gets stabbed in the neck. Now, another thing, we had these, there were little suites. There was a living room, and then there were two bedrooms, one on each side, and there were five guys in each one. They just had five beds. And there we are. They were, and some of the rooms had a real small patio. And one night, middle of the night, one of our guys, not in our suite, but one of our guys heard a thump on their patio. And they looked out, and somebody had tried to commit suicide, jumping off the top of the hotel. It didn't make it all the way down, landed on their patio. And he wasn't dead. And, oh, it was a traumatic experience for those guys, as you can imagine. The third thing that happened is my dad came on a business trip to New York. And so I remember going out to eat, and he said, let's go over to Madison Square Garden. And I don't know if we were going to go to a basketball game, a Knicks game. I don't remember exactly why. In fact, I don't think it was a game. I think he just wanted to show it to me. And so as we were going over to Madison Square Garden, we heard a bam, bam, bam. And we turned around, and there was an armed robbery in progress across the street, maybe 50 yards. And this guy's running down the street with a gun in his hand. And I said, this is a pretty unusual place. But I survived it, moved back to Miami, and began my career as a stockbroker. Well, within a couple of years, I realized that that was not going to bring me happiness either. It just wasn't. I just had that void, and here I was making some money, and but I was trying to be around guys that had money because they're the ones with the stock portfolios to generate commissions. And back then, 1971-72, the Miami Dolphins had their perfect season. So Miami was abuzz with the Dolphins and everything, and I was trying so hard to run in their circle, and I didn't do it very well. But I was trying so, I just overreaching to try to reach those kinds of people. And the more I was around people like that, the more I realized they did not have the answers to life. And I never forget, I called my mother back home in Iowa and told her I was just depressed, and I was in tears. And told her I was depressed, and she said, have you tried going to church? I said, Mom, I haven't gone to church since my accident. And I don't know how many years had been there. She said, well, I want you to promise me you will go to church this Sunday. I said, okay, I promise you. So I remember hanging up the phone, and now I've got to find a church. I grew up Methodist, but I wasn't married to the Methodist church. I said, I'm going to drive around the wealthiest section of Miami, which was Coral Gables, and I'm going to look for the richest church I can find. So if this religious stuff doesn't work out, I'll be able to make some contacts for my brokerage accounts. So I found this beautiful church called Granada Presbyterian Church. And that Sunday morning, I got dressed in my finest and put some business cards in my pocket, and I went and heard for the very first time this minister talk about how you can have a personal relationship with Christ. And I'd never heard that. Maybe it had been preached, but I just never heard that. And I thought, well, maybe it's just these weird Presbyterians, and or maybe it's just this clergy. And I looked in the bulletin, and it said that in the evening they had a singles group. And I said, well, I was single. I want to meet some babes. So I remember going to the singles group that very night. And the Granada Church was real close to the University of Miami. And they were, and this was the time where Campus Crusade for Christ was very new on college campuses. And young people were getting converted and coming to know Christ. And this singles group at the church had a lot of my peers in it, and people my own age. And they were talking about having a personal relationship with Christ. Well, it took about 6 months before I really got figured the pieces in the puzzle, and I finally accepted Christ as my Lord and Savior. And he changed my life. It wasn't all of a sudden, but he started changing, and it was really good. I remember joining a men's Bible study on Wednesday morning for breakfast. And there were about 12 men, maybe 15 men, that rented out this room in this restaurant on Lejeune Road. And they were studying the Bible. I couldn't believe these men, successful men from this fancy church. And they were interested in the Bible. So I started learning and growing. And, you know, in the next couple of years, I was learning and growing. And then I met my first wife, Pam, and she was going to that church. And we fell in love and got married. And lo and behold, I sensed that God was calling me in the ministry. Now, I didn't, I don't know any particular verse or anything, but I do know exactly when it happened. It was April 1st, 1972. And I know it was a Saturday morning, and I was home in our little apartment. We'd been married for about a year. Home in an apartment, and I was home alone. I don't know where Pam was, the grocery shopping or doing whatever. And I was having my quiet time, and I just sensed God put in my heart to go in the ministry. So I didn't know what all that meant, but I knew enough to take it seriously. So actually, the very next day, April 2nd of 72, was Easter Sunday, and Billy Graham was speaking at the Miami Seaquarium at the sunrise service. So I remember I was getting up real early on that April 2nd. It was the day after I thought God was calling me in the ministry, and going to hear Billy Graham, Easter sunrise service at the Miami Seaquarium. And just how powerful that was, and God was really speaking to me. I thought, I just can't resign from Merrill Lynch and go on and go to seminary. I need to get some advice from some people. I really did not why the markets were good. I was enjoying being a stockbroker. I was enjoying being a young layman, kind of a favorite son of this church, actually. And boy, I liked the lifestyle that I was living, and just gotten married, and you know, things seemed good. So I decided that I would go and ask for advice from four different men, that our youth pastor, the president of a college down there that I'd gotten to know, a businessman who was in their Wednesday morning Bible study. Then I forget who the fourth one was. But, I told them about this call. All four of them gave me four totally different pieces of advice. So I wasn't confirmed at all. So I just dragged my heels for 14 more months until God really made it clear that that's where he wanted me to go. So I cashed in what few chips I had in the market and went off to Reformed Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi. Back then, that was the only Reformed Seminary. Now there's a big one here in Orlando, and they're in Charlotte and Atlanta, Washington, D.C. Reformed Seminaries really spread out and gotten bigger. Back then, it was young, and that's where you had to go, to Jackson, Mississippi. So, and I went there. We went there for 3 years, and I really enjoyed it, even though I wasn't a good student. I really enjoyed it. And one thing I really enjoyed about it is that in order to help finance this endeavor, I took two little rural churches to preach at, about 100 miles from Jackson. One of the churches met on the first and third Sunday of the month. The other met second and fourth. They were real small. One had 30 people. Another had maybe 40. And probably less. And so I only had to prepare two sermons. But they really kept my feet on the ground, because I'd learn all this academic theology and everything during the week. And then on the weekend, I would go and talk about those folks about Jesus. And they didn't really care about my theology and all my academics. They just wanted to know about the Lord. So that was great. So now it's time to come to Orlando to start a church. I really wanted to start a church. I don't know. I didn't know much about it, but I wanted to come back to Florida and to start a church in Orlando. Even though I went to Orlando one time when Disney opened in 1971. I went to, we came up from Miami. I think it was the first year we were married. Came up with good friends of ours, Ray and Priscilla Smith, and their kids, and we didn't have any kids at the time. And we went to Disney for a couple of days. But I didn't know anything about Orlando, but somehow the Lord put Orlando on my heart to go to start a church in Orlando. Well, after my very first year in seminary in Jackson, I found out in our denomination who was the big shot that is in charge of starting churches in Orlando. And because Orlando had no PCA church. And actually, Orlando didn't have many good churches at all back in the mid-70s. Any good evangelical churches. I'm sure there's other good churches that just weren't as solid biblically. So I found out from the big shot, David Nicholas, and he was down in Boca Raton, and he was in charge of starting churches in Florida. So I contacted him and said, you know, Dr. Nicholas, I'm Chuck Green. I'm up here at Reformed Seminary, and I'd like to come and start a church in Orlando when I graduate. He says, well, you're a day late and a dollar short, and we're not going to hire you for two reasons. Number one, you're still in seminary, and number two, we're ready to go right now with the church, and we don't want to hire some new seminary graduate for such a ripe city as Orlando. Oh, and I was just crushed. I really thought that's what God had shown me. So I was just crushed, and the end of my second year, I contacted him again. I said, Dr. Nicholas, you know, I spoke to you last year, and I really liked coming to Orlando. And he said, you know, Green, I can't believe you're bothering me again. I told you last year, don't call me, I'll call you. I said, well, what's going on in Orlando? He said, well, we've just offered the job to this minister, and he's got great experience, and we don't want to hire some new graduate. Oh, boy. I was crushed again. So my third year seminary, at Christmas time, I contacted Dr. Nicholas again. I said, you know, I'd really like to come and hey, Green, I told you. And I said, well, what's the deal with the guy? You said you gave him a job, offered him the job last summer. He said, well, he hadn't decided yet, but we're sure he is. It's a can't-miss situation. I said, what do you mean he hadn't decided? Don't you want some guy that really feels called there? Why would you let some guy drag you along for, 6 or 8 months or whatever it is? And I kind of got a little feisty back with him. I later found out that he liked that, and he was 6'6" and played basketball at the University of Miami. So he liked a little vigor. So he said, well, don't call me back. I'll call you. Well, February 5th, 1973, I remember. And the phone rings. He said, Chuck, this is David Nicholas. I said, David who? He said, Nicholas. He said, the guy that was going to take this church turned it down. And you've been bugging me for 3 years. I'll let you come and interview for this church. And so I flew down to Orlando and interviewed with, there were a few people, about 20 people who wanted to start a church. And we got along just real well. And then David Nicholas was real concerned about my handicap. So after I met in Orlando with these 20 people, he wanted me to fly down to Boca Raton where he could really, and stay at his house for a couple of days. And so he could really examine me and see how I would function with a handicap. So I'll never forget going down there. He was such an intimidating guy. And he wanted to hear me preach, so I preached at his church on Sunday night. This is after Sunday morning. I'd been in Orlando. I went down Sunday afternoon, preached in his church, and apparently I passed the preaching part of it. And then the next day, he said, come on, you're coming with me. We got to go visit the hospitals. Oh, my goodness. And he's this great big guy, and he took these long strides. And I'm on walk with a cane, and I'm hurrying and huffing and puffing. And but finally, he said I could go to Orlando. So came here in June of 1976. We started Orangewood, a little storefront on Colonial Drive. 20 feet wide, 80 feet deep. It looked like a bowling alley when you go into it. But it was really a wonderful experience, because the people that wanted to start the church, they have the right convictions. They're willing to make a lot of sacrifices. They're going to sacrifice stained glass and an organ and a choir and big youth programs and things like that, just because they wanted a Bible-believing evangelical Presbyterian church. Well, we didn't know how you're supposed to start a church. There weren't any books or seminars, so we just decided that we just start knocking on doors and inviting people to come to church. And that's what we did. I used to call Rotary clubs and other civic organizations and ask if I could come and speak to their club or their luncheon meeting or breakfast meeting or whatever. And I didn't get anybody that wanted me to come speak, but they said, why don't you come and you can pray for our lunch or breakfast or whatever it was, because everybody likes to have somebody pray and kind of baptize their whole agenda. But they just didn't want me to speak. Well, there was a Publix that was opening up on Colonial Drive, and they were going to have this big ribbon cutting. And I contacted the Publix person who was in charge of it, and I said, how would you like for me to have a prayer when you open your Publix next Saturday morning? And they said, oh, that's probably a good idea. We'll do that. So I remember getting there, and there's, a decent crowd of people. And I remember taking the mic, and the ribbon was there. They were just about to cut it, and they said, okay, we're first going to pray for the food and the grocery store. And so I started praying, Lord, thank you for this Publix and can provide the food for life for all these folks downtown. Most of all, we thank you for the bread of life, Jesus himself, and what he means to us, and the fact that we can learn more about him at Orangewood Presbyterian Church, 128 East Colonial Drive, 10:30 a.m., nursery provided. And, you know, that went over okay. And we had other people, you know, that would stagger into the church. And after 1 year, we had grown from 20 people to 59. Man, today's growth, that ain't much at all. But back then, I was telling people we tripled. Went from 20 to 59 in a year. We also did something kind of fun. We went to General Assembly. General Assembly is our annual convention. It's held every June in different places. And at that time, it was held in, I believe it was in Charlotte, North Carolina, in this big church. And I went there with another one of our elders for the week of meetings. But I really wanted Orangewood to have a name that would be recognizable in our denomination, and recognizable actually all the way around the world. We had a big vision, and when we named Orangewood, we said we didn't want to name it Faith Presbyterian or Covenant Presbyterian or First or Second. We wanted a name that would so identify us with Orlando. And we thought of citrus, and we actually got out the phone book when we first started the church with these 20 people. And we said, citrus? No. How about oranges? So we went down the phone book and looked, orange this, orange that, and there was nothing that said Orangewood. We said, that's what it'll be, Orangewood Presbyterian Church. Well, a year later, when we're going to General Assembly in Charlotte, we took a bucket, our basket of oranges, bushel basket of oranges. And in the church, in the fellowship hall, that's kind of where they would have breaks and coffee and cokes and cookies and, you know, set up with other vendors or kiosks or whatever, where everybody would be meandering around. Well, we set up a card table, just a card table in the corner of fellowship hall. And we had this bushel basket. We tipped the bushel basket kind of upside down and let the oranges kind of spill out. And we just put a sign there that said, oranges from Orangewood. Well, now, the first couple of days, everybody's doing coffee and cookies and everything. But by about third day, people are wanting something a little bit more healthy. And lo and behold, people are just stopping. And it was an unmanned table. But people are stopping and picking up an orange, or this is an orange, and peeling an orange. And say, orange is orange. Where is Orangewood? What? And somebody else say, isn't that church that tripled in Orlando last year? And so we were off and running. We thought that, okay, a lot of people have heard about us now. So if somebody in Chicago is moving down to Orlando, we want somebody to tell them about this church named Orangewood. They should come visit. So that's how we did that. And then we were 4 years later in 1980, two interesting things happened. One, our the Orlando Chamber of Commerce did a study of what trends were going to be, what are the trends of the day in 1980, but especially, what are the trends going to be 20 years from now in the year 2000? Everybody in 1980, as we turn into a new decade, everybody is talking about the year 2000. And probably the reason that we're trying to do some forecasting is because the 1970s were really kind of abysmal, because Disney came in 71 and nobody had any idea the impact Disney would have. So everybody said, let's start thinking ahead. So the Chamber of Commerce did, and I don't remember any of their results except one. They said, let's try to guess where we think the center of population will be for Greater Orlando. And they came up and they said, we think the center of population of Greater Orlando in 20 years will be right around I-4 and Maitland Boulevard. And we said, by the grace of God, that's where we want to go. So we started looking for property around I-4 and Maitland Boulevard. What we didn't realize is that we weren't the only ones that read that article. Everybody's looking for property, and most people were businesses that had money. We were a little church that didn't have money. But we found this Greek church, Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church, and they had 10 acres, and we finally kind of talked them into selling us 5 of their acres. And sure enough, we moved up onto their property and in a building that was 100 by 100, and we took off. The other interesting thing that happened in 1980 is we started a school, Orangewood Christian School, and we had one family that really wanted to start it. Bob and Barbara Butterfield had this 6-year-old girl named Meg. And Meg Butterfield, and her name now is Magus, Meg Magus. She's married and got a couple of kids, just a lovely lady now. And so we decided that we would start a school. Now, the conventional way you start a school back then is you start one grade, start first grade. And then the next year, you have first and second grade, and then you build a grade a year. Well, we had one member of our church who was in the Navy, and he had 8 kids. And he said, I have 6 kids, 6 of my 8 are in elementary school age. And if you'll start all 6 grades, I'll put all 6 of my kids in the school. Well, we didn't want to start 6 grades. But we needed his kids, and we needed the money, so we did. And we had 18 kids that first year, and we were meeting down that storefront. We had 2 small study-through classes, and the one class was grades 1, 2, 3, and the other class was grades 4, 5, and 6. We had one teacher who was a volunteer, and the other one we paid. And it was really fun and exciting, And the parents were excited, and it was just really great. We were just out there on the edge, trusting God was something that nobody else would really make sense of. Well, the second year of the school, in 1981, the guy in the Navy was transferred. Oh, we went from 18 kids down to 12, and it was discouraging. Oh, no, and then the next year, we just didn't know if God was going to bless the church. Maybe we thought maybe we read the signals wrong. So we started praying for the following year praying for students. And that is the year 1982 that we bought that property from the Greeks. And we put up that building. And that third year, we had 54 students. And so we went to grades 1 and 2 together, 3 and 4 and 5 and 6. And Linda actually was the first and second grade teacher then. Well, we were off and running once we got in that new building, our own building, and it was growing, and that was fun. And after the very first year, we'd almost doubled again. We moved in with 180 people, our first service in 82. There, and within a year, we'd gone to about 300, so we had to start looking for property. And we wanted to stay at I-4 somewhere in Maitland Boulevard area. So we set about looking for property in the in this I-4 Maitland quadrant. And lo and behold, all the property on the west side of the interstate was being purchased by the Maitland Center, and all the big buildings were going over there. And Maitland said they didn't want office buildings on the east side of I-4, but they wanted the residential area on the east side and the Maitland Center buildings on the west side. So one piece of property, in fact, it's the piece of property where my house is right now. My house was on this 55-acre piece of property. It was a burnt out orange grove, and it had been frozen. So the trees were all dead, and it was really close to the Greek church and our other grade school. Well, I became convinced that God was going to give us that property, that Coca-Cola was going to give us that property. And Coca-Cola, based in Atlanta, but their foods division, and it was Minute Maid. They bought Minute Maid, and this was an old Minute Maid parcels around Orlando. And so Coca-Cola bought Minute Maid, and so therefore they owned this piece of property that's frozen, dead trees. And I'm just convinced. I just think Coca-Cola Foods doesn't even know where this piece of property is. So surely they're going to give it to us. I remember writing them, their foundation, and they came back real fast and said, we don't give property to churches. I'm not property. We don't make donations to churches. That everybody would be wanting a donation, and all of our employees want donations for their own churches, so we don't do that. Well, I really wanted to talk to, the CEO, and about making this gift, and I was going to work the school angle. If they didn't do the church, then I was going to work the school angle. Surely they've got a heart for kids. So I tried getting this guy. His name was Bill Middlebrooks, the president of Coca-Cola Foods. And I tried to get an appointment with him. I couldn't get an appointment with him. And he had a secretary. And she was the typical kind of secretary that would look down over her glasses, you know. And, I'd call her, and I'd like to see Mr. Middlebrooks. I'll be out there next week, and da-da-da-da-da. She said, no, Mr. Middlebrooks isn't available. Da-da-da-da-da. What's this about? I said, well, I really can't tell you. Well, forget that. And so finally, I just went to see Mr. Bill Middlebrooks, president of Coca-Cola Foods, and went to his office, and lo and behold, there's that secretary, Mrs. I don't remember her name, but it must have been something like Snodgrass, Mrs. Snodgrass, protecting the fortress that was the president of Coca-Cola Foods. And I said, Ms. Snodgrass, I'm Chuck Green. I'm here to see Mr. Middlebrooks. She said, well, you don't have an appointment. I said, I know, but I know that I only need 5 minutes with him. And she said, well, I'm sorry. He's very busy, and he cannot be reached. I said, well, I know how busy he is, but 5 minutes, I know that he's going to want to see me. And why do you want it? Why do you think he wants to see you? She said, what's this about? I said, Miss, I really can't tell you. And then she pushed me on that, and finally I told her, I said, Ms. Snodgrass, Mr. Middlebrooks might not want you to know what I've got to talk about with him. Oh, my goodness. Well, she thought now this was something moral or something, whatever, and that he had a secret and I was the only one that knew it. And I knew I was cutting corners here just to try to get in and see this guy. So finally she said, well, you can wait downstairs. I said, I'll just catch him when he's going to lunch, catch him between appointments. She said, well, you can wait downstairs in the waiting room, whatever. I said, no, I'll just wait here and just try to catch him. Well, I was walking with a cane at that time, and I decided that I was going to stay in her office, but I was just going to stay standing up. And so I went over and kind of looked out the window, and then I kept inching closer and closer to her desk, just making her feel all the more uncomfortable. Finally, I'm standing right there at her desk and overlooking everything. She's just driven nuts. She disappears for a minute, comes back and said, you've got 5 minutes and I'm timing it. I said, thank you very much. I went in to see Mr. Middlebrooks. My name's Chuck Green, and I'm pastor of a church in Orlando, Maitland, Florida, and we've got a big school, and we're doing some neat things, but we've run out of space, and you're There's a old Coca-Cola. There's an old Minute Maid piece of property with some dead citrus trees on it that I'd like to see if you guys would give us so we'll be able to educate these young people. And he said, oh, you mean plot 209.317. I said, oh, no. He knows well about it. He knows exactly about it. He didn't get to be the president without, remembering stuff like this. He said, it's a 55-acre track, and yes, we have decided that we are going to sell it, and we'll be happy to sell it to you for $200,000 an acre. I said, oh, Mr. Middlebrooks, you're killing me. You're killing me. Surely you'll give it. Well, I was just devastated because I was just so convinced God was going to do that. I was so convinced that God was going to do that that before I went, on the Saturday morning before I went, I had the men from the church come to my house. And I told them that I really wanted to pray over this Coca-Cola property. And I said, so much so, I want us to go over there right now and pray on that property and claim it for the Lord. So these guys, I don't know, maybe 25 guys, we all drove our cars over to this property. And again, it's just nothing but 55 acres of dead orange trees. And we find a little spot. And I wanted to push these guys to say, should we march around it, seven times like Joshua? We're not marching, Chuck. And I said, well, let's and cars are going by and they're honking or waving part of their hands, and I said, well, let's hold hands and pray. Chuck, we're not holding hands. We're going to pray and claim this for the Lord. So we did. So now I've got to now come back and face these guys and tell them that Coca-Cola said no. And I was just so disappointed. Just again, it's one of those things where you have highs and lows, and as a Christian, and you know God's in control, but it's sure more fun when things are going your way than when things don't appear to be going your way. But God is so sovereign. He had it all worked out because this piece of property, this 55-acre Coca-Cola piece of property, would not be near as visible or accessible as the 17-acre property that he eventually gave us. He didn't give it to us. We had to buy it. Where the church is now, and it was owned by the Hope Strong family, Winter Park family, and we talked to them, and I had nothing to do with this deal. It's probably a good thing. But they said, the Hope Strong family said, they would sell us that 17.5-acre piece of property if we could get it under contract within 30 days, and we were able to do that. They said, if you'll do that, he said, we'll sell it to you at $100,000 an acre, and we off that, we'll give you a $25,000 an acre gift. And so the net price would be $75 an acre. And that was great, but we didn't know how we were going to come up with the money. But by God's grace, we were able to come up with the money and then build the building. Well, there was a problem coming when we went to build our first building. We wanted a red brick building. So much in Orlando is block and stucco, and we want to have a red brick building. And we wanted a multi-purpose building where we could worship and also where the kids could use it for the school. It just didn't make sense. We just didn't have enough money to build several million dollars into a sanctuary that we could only use for a couple hours on Sunday. We needed a facility we could use multi-purpose-wise. So that's what we decided to do. Well, the builders laid the slab, and they started going up with the brick walls. And, oh, it was so cool. I mean, I was going by it every day. It's so neat when they're building, and at that stage, such visible progress. Well, after a few days, the workers showed up, and they noticed there was a crack in the wall. And they kind of patched up the crack, and the next day, there's a crack in another wall. And after 3 or 4 days of this, they suspended construction. And they said, we might have a problem with the foundation. And they found out that we were building on top of a sinkhole. Oh, it was crushing. Whenever you build, you have to get soil test bearings. I learned all of this kind of the hard way. And what you do is the architects and all the engineers, you try to figure out what is the weight of the building going to be. And then the weight of the building when it's got fully all the people and cars and everything else. And depending on the weight of the building, that's how far down you have to drill to make sure you have solid foundation. So we thought, I don't remember the number now, but let's say it was like 60 feet. And that was where we drilled down. Everything was cleared, 60 feet. Well, when we started drilling back after that, we found out there was a sinkhole that was 65 feet down. And now we were having cracks. Well, what do you do? What do you do? I mean, I'm so thankful that it happened then rather than once the building was up. Well, we decided that we would try to fill the sinkhole. But we didn't know how big it was. You can't drop a little man down there with a lantern. And so we started pouring grout, just cheap concrete, down. And it took 1,000 cubic yards of grout. I remember asking the building committee, I said, I don't have any perspective on 1,000 cubic yards. And they said, Chuck, you know, when you're driving down, down the road and you come up behind a cement truck, well, that cement truck has 10 cubic yards. So just imagine 100 cement trucks up and down Maitland Boulevard pouring grout down that hole. It costs us $106,000. And we were tight financially anyway. And yes, we did have insurance, but insurance, they're pretty quick to collect their premiums, pretty slow to pay out claims. They didn't pay us for 5 years. And we had a cash flow problem, but God saw us through. So we used to joke and say, well, now we have a church that's literally built on a solid rock of Jesus and the solid rock of all this grout. Church continued to grow, and we were so blessed. And then I want to say then a couple things I omitted. Well, let me finish with the church, and I'll come back to the kids. We started several daughter churches. We didn't want to be a mega church. We wanted to have daughter churches, so we started Pine Ridge Fellowship in South Orlando and Willow Creek out in Tuscaloosa with Pete Hallwinson and University Presbyterian Church by UCF and the New City Presbyterian Church. I think it's just New City Church, downtown Orlando. And so God really blessed it. And we really, God did it. God did it more in spite of me and not because of me. And I don't say that. I hope that's not false humility, because I am so thankful and so grateful that God used me to do this. I mean, I'm just humbled by that. And so I say that, giving him all the praise, but with a big smile on my face, because he chose to do so much of it through me. Well, Pam and I could not have kids, so we decided we would adopt kids. And we adopted David, 1978. He was his birthday, January 8th, 1978. And we got him 17 days later when he's 17 days old. So we really got him early. What to name him? Well, January 8th is Elvis Presley's birthday. So I wanted to name him Elvis. But I didn't get very far with that between Pam vetoing that, but also everybody in the church. They told me I couldn't do that. So, oh man, that was so much fun having David. And then 2 years later, 1980, January 11th, Holly was born. We got her when she was 2 months old. Oh man, it was so much fun raising these two little kids and babies and just watching them grow up. And, it was just great. We, I'm trying to think where to go from here. David was a real challenge to us. David was our prodigal son for many, many years, and he was doing drugs and all that in his mid-teens, and here he was. He was a typical preacher's kid and just kind of rebelling again, never against me personally. We always maintained a pretty good relationship, but everything I stood for. And I knew I had to get him out of Orangewood School, his dad's school, and I didn't want the school to have to be embarrassed with him. And you got the preacher's kid doing drugs, and you know, it's such a nest egg for gossip, and I didn't want David to be a part of that, but I didn't want the school people to feel they couldn't really discipline him. So we took him out. We took him to French Camp Academy, a wonderful place in French Camp, Mississippi. And he was there for a couple of years before he graduated. And he did well there. I said he did well there. He was thrown out once for smoking pot. And then when he got out of there, he got in trouble with the law. And and the judge said, I won't throw you in jail if you'll enroll in the Army, enlist in the Army. And he said, that's great. So he enlisted in the Army, and we thought that was a perfect place for him. And he got in the Army, and then he found a gal that he fell in love with and wanted to marry, and Misty, and that was in Oklahoma, and they got married. They had a child, Chloe, and Chloe's just sweet little gal. She's 16 right now, as I dictate this, in 2014. But David and Misty, boy, they just didn't mix at all. So they they divorced, and then David got out of the Army and got into some other legal problems, and just really broke my heart for many, many years, until finally, several years ago, he, in prison, really turned his life over to the Lord. And I'm so thankful of that. Now we can talk about the Lord and things like that. And he's had his slip-ups, but he's really trying, and I so respect him for that. And you just don't know when you adopt somebody the propensity they might have for drugs and that kind of thing. And that's where we were with David. He was a real heartache, but he's a real blessing now. Holly, boy, what a joy she is. And she wasn't as overtly rebellious as David was, but she still had a little thing about being the preacher's kid. And she would, it just wasn't really terrible. But in fact, she came to me one time and she said, Dad, I want to say something to you, but I really don't want you to respond by saying anything. I said, okay. She said, I would like to apologize to you for everything that happened between the ages of 16 and 22. And I said, apology accepted, although I wanted to go into some real details of what she needs to be apologizing for, but I accepted her apology. And she went to Georgia Southern, where she met her future husband, Kevin. And then she became a flight attendant with Delta. The academic route was not quite what, it didn't quite fit Holly, so she became a stewardess flight attendant. Don't call them stewardess anymore, with Delta, and that was just great, just made for her. Until about 2 years after she was doing it, 9/11 hit. And so she was laid off, and she came back to Orlando and got a job. But Kevin, who they'd maintained a friendship, he was assigned a construction project here at the Orlando airport. So they got together and fell in love and eventually got married, and now have these really two cute kids, Kaysen and Karis. we get to see Kaysen and Karis now that they're living in Orlando. Now, by the time you're listening to this tape, DVD, not DVD, CD, they might not be in Orlando at all. But we've sure loved the time that they've been here. Not really for Kevin and Holly, but more for Karis and Kaysen. It's just been a great experience to be, on hand grandparents. I'm trying to see if there's anything else that I wanted to mention here. I'm sure that there are other things that I'll think about. But let's just... Oh, boy, I did have a couple of things. Oh, my goodness, I can't believe it. I was really ahead of the curve on a couple of things. Really, on one thing. This is one of those things, you know, where you say you just missed the lottery. Well, I'm sure there are people that really just missed the lottery. They're off by one number or something. Well, this had nothing to do with the lottery. But when I was in college, Jacksonville University, I was the president of my senior class. Now, that sounds so great and so lofty. The truth is, nobody else wanted to be it. I think it was another guy. And I wanted it just for my resume. Since I wasn't a good student, I really wanted something on my resume. So I was president of my senior class. Well, the only responsibility that I really had is that you get to have some input, supposedly, on the graduation speaker. So I remember going into the president's office. Now, this was 1968 when I graduated from college. And I remember going into the president, Dr. Robert Spiro, his office, and said, "Dr. Spiro, I have a great idea for our graduation speaker." He said, "Okay, let's hear it." I said, "I think we should invite Johnny Carson to be our graduation speaker." He leaned back and laughed at me. That is the most ridiculous thing in the world, to have an entertainer speak at a graduation, at a commencement. Graduations are supposed to have the academics, and he just laughed me out of his office. Well, of course, the rest is history. Within a year or two, the most popular celebrity that spoke at commencements was Bill Cosby. And Bill Cosby did it, and pretty soon other celebrities were doing it. And it was really an entertainment. They took the academics out of commencement speeches. And I was always a little bit disappointed that we didn't get Johnny Carson. I met Johnny Carson once, and he really meant a lot to me. When I got hurt in January of 63, he took over The Tonight Show in October of 62. And being in Iowa, it came on earlier. It came on at 10:30 rather than the Eastern time zone of 11:30. And the whole time that I was in the hospital, those 8 months, I watched Johnny Carson every night from 10:30 to 12. It was an hour and a half show back then. And after my first year of college, I couldn't get a job. So a friend of mine from college decided that we would drive out west. We'd just take a trip and drive out west. We had a roommate, a fraternity brother, lived in Los Angeles. So we were going to do that. And I remember we had the biggest time, but we stopped in Las Vegas because Johnny Carson back then performed in Las Vegas at the Sahara Hotel for 30 days for about three summers when he first had the Tonight Show. So we got tickets and went to his dinner show. And I wrote a little note on a piece of paper and asked the server, the maitre d', if he would make sure this gets to Johnny Carson. And lo and behold, Johnny Carson comes out, and he's so entertaining with his jokes and singing and playing some instruments, especially the drums. And it was so much fun. And finally, he said, "I also have a note here from Chuck Green. And I wonder, Chuck, if you could come backstage to my dressing room after the show." Well, I thought that was pretty cool. So I remember going backstage and meeting Johnny Carson and tell him how much that he'd meant to me that first year when I had my accident. So that's why I was always wanted Johnny Carson to come be our graduation speaker. But no, I'm going to close with this one. As I'm looking at this, I want to close with this one story, and then I guess I should. I got two stories. I guess the well, I've got it more than that because I've had some health issues here recently. Oh my! I don't know how we're doing time wise, but we're okay. All right. The joy of my life is my marriage. And when Pam and I divorced, it was crushing to me and to the church. And it just was really painful. And she left and took the kids to Ocala, and she married real fast this fella that she had gotten involved with. And I was seeing the kids every other weekend, and it was so, so painful. But one thing that that came out of it is the weekends were so busy for me as a minister. I got weddings on Saturday afternoon and prayer breakfast on Saturday morning, and we've got different services on Sunday morning, and I needed somebody that could watch the kids. So I decided that I would ask Linda LePage. She was their first grade teacher, and she was very close to our kids, especially Holly, because the divorce happened right when Holly was about that age in first grade. And so I would have Linda, can you come Saturday afternoon? I've got a wedding. And she would do that. Or Sunday morning, we had two services. I'd ask if she'd come before the early service so I could go to the early service and she could get the kids up to go to Sunday school in the late service. And so, lo and behold, we're cruising along and things are going pretty good. But Lynn and I start, you know, looking at each other just a little differently. Just a little differently. It's one of those things where you think, what did she mean by that look? Or what did she mean by that phrase? And she's thought the same thing. And we'd start talking, long talks after the kids had long gone to bed. And long talks. And we were really enjoying each other, not knowing exactly what God's doing or what we were doing. So, in fact, Linda went to our associate pastor, Carl Smith, and said, "Carl, I'm going to have to leave the church." Carl says, "What in the world for?" She said, "I'm starting to have feelings for my pastor." And Carl said, "Yes, relax, that's okay." And so then after a while, I went to each of our elders, and I asked, "Would you mind if I started dating Linda LePage?" At that time, she was our elementary principal. And they all gave a hearty amen to that. Matter of fact, it was kind of like, you know, the women in the church were saying, "It is not good for Chuck to be alone. We must find a helpmate for him." And they'd already picked out Linda for me. And I was just a little slow in coming to grips with it. But boy, oh boy, we fell in love. We got, let's say, our first date was September on my birthday. And in January, 4 months later, we got engaged. We got married 3 months later in April. And oh my goodness, it was such a whirlwind romance. But it was not just for us, it's so wonderful, but for the church. The church saw me, I felt like a bullfighter in a ring. The church saw me get stabbed. They saw me bleed. They saw me cry. They saw me try to get out of the ring. And they saw that God wouldn't let me out of the ring. And then to come all full circle to see God's provision with Linda, it gave the church just wonderful affirmation that God is in control and God does have a plan, and he even uses messy divorces in the plan. And so that was just great. Linda and I have always said it's kind of like the Sound of Music. I was the Mr. Senior Von Trapp. I was the Mr. Big Shot with the church. And she was kind of the nanny watching the kids. And so obviously our favorite movie is The Sound of Music. But I think the other story I was going to tell was my Super Bowl story. I just noticed here I've been blessed to have 3 service dogs in the last 20 years. That's been a big part of my life. I also had a minor stroke 5 years ago, and real minor, and then had some heart problems last year in 2013. But one thing I conveniently omitted was that I was really started to deteriorate back in the mid-90s, and finally in 1995, 96, I forget which, the Lord showed me that I needed to retire. I needed to take disability retirement. My doctor said that my legs were like rubber bands that were being stretched. And he said, you just don't know when they're going to break. And he said, if you get a break, it's going to be really detrimental. And then I needed to start going to a scooter and then a wheelchair. And I know I did not want to do that at the church. The church had really grown and had about 1,200 people there attending in the mid-90s. And I had real demands with the people and the staff and funds and everything. So I just could not do that anymore. So I decided to retire, and that was hard physically and emotionally. So, but it was the right decision. Now, my Super Bowl story. Well, I got out of college in Jacksonville in June of 68 and working at the bank. And then in January of 69, I believe it was January 22nd, was going to be Super Bowl III. And like I was saying, the AFL and the NFL. Now, whoever's listening to this, you probably don't remember this, but this is a part of sports history, that the NFL was a real powerful. It had Johnny Unitas and the Baltimore Colts. The AFL had other teams such as the New York Jets with Joe Namath, Broadway Joe, and he was real flashy. Well, they came to Miami to play Super Bowl III in the Orange Bowl, and Joe Namath was over at the Diplomat Hotel on South Beach. Well, you know, South Beach now is popular. Back then, it wasn't that popular. But and he was spouting out all these guarantees that he's gonna, you know, that they're gonna beat the Colts. They were 17-point underdogs. Well, because of his flamboyance, I decided I've got to go see this game. Only one problem: I didn't have a ticket. So I decided on that day, that Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday, that I would just go and try to get in and try to sneak in. Well, I had a press pass, and that I'd had at Jacksonville University, that I was doing some things at different times for the Jacksonville University newspaper, and I don't remember anything I did for them. I do know that I got a press pass, and back then you didn't have to have all these credentials you do now, so I decided I'm going to try to sneak in with a press pass. So I get to the Orange Bowl, and the hype and the excitement is so great. Well, how am I going to sneak in? I said, well, I'm going to look for a ticket taker at one of these little booths, where, and look for one that looks nice. And so finally, I saw this lady taking tickets, and there was a long line, and that's what I wanted. I wanted a long line. So I got in this long line, and I waited, and I got up to the lady, and I showed her my press pass. And she said, "Sorry, sir, but the press is to enter at gate 17. All press has to enter at gate 17. I said, "Oh, come on, man, give the guy a break here. I mean, all this line, give the guy a break." And now I'm holding up the line. People behind me are saying, "Come on, what's the..." Finally, she says, "Okay, go ahead." Holy schmoly, I am in the Super Bowl. And I go in, and I go through one of the tunnels, and there is the Super Bowl, the Orange Bowl. They have the New York Jets. They're, you know, warming up, and the Colts are warming up. And this is just fabulous. But I've got another problem. Where am I going to sit? I don't have a seat. And I can't just sit somewhere. Every seat's taken. And I noticed that on the field, behind the Jets bench, were some metal folding chairs. Brown ones and gray ones. I even remember the colors. Brown ones and gray ones. And I said, "I am going to go and try to see if I can sit on the field behind the Jets bench." Now, I was just, you know, I was 22, 23 years old trying to bluff my way through this stuff. And I got all the way down to the field, the gate there, and I just held up my press pass to this guy and acted like I knew exactly what I was doing. And he let me on that field. And again, you know, they didn't have strict credentials back then. Now you could never do that. And I walked over on my cane and opened up one of those metal chairs. And I sat down right behind the Jets bench and watched the whole game right from the Jets perspective. Now, I couldn't see much of the game, truth be told. All these big guys were in front of me, and they didn't have the big screens at the jumbotrons at the end of the stadium. So I couldn't see much, but the ambiance of where I was and what I was doing, and I mean, I was following, I just couldn't see much. And lo and behold, the Jets win the game, and people are going nuts. People are just absolutely going nuts, and the Jets, you know, and everybody's leaving the stadium and everything, and I'm just saying, what have I just experienced? This is great. I said, could there be any, is there any dessert? I mean, what topping could I put on here? What would be the cherry on top of this frosting? I know, the locker room. So I decided that I was going to go and sneak into the Jets locker room. I was going to push this as far as I could. And lo and behold, I get to the locker room, and all these people are outside the locker room, and all the wives and you know, all the hangers-on. And I just go up to the door like I belong there, and the guy lets me in. And I go in there, and I'm watching Joe Namath is standing on a bench with a towel, naked except a towel wrapped around him, and he's answering questions from the press. It's kind of his press conference. And I knew I didn't want to get too close there or else I might get found out. So I kind of stood off in a distance just listening to him. And here comes this other guy from the showers, naked as a jaybird, got a towel wrapped around him. And it's their leading receiver, Don Maynard. And Don Maynard starts, you know, getting dressed. I'm standing right in front of his locker. So I'm starting to talk to Don Maynard about the game and this and that. And I said, "Don, is it like this every game with Joe entertaining the press?" And he said, "It sure is." And so that was my Super Bowl story. Unfortunately, I didn't have a camera. I didn't have proof. I didn't have any proof of it. But it was the highlight of my sports career. That's it for now. If I ever want to add something to it, I'll call you and say, I thought of a couple other things.